I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, acclaimed writer Salman Rushdie, is lucky to be alive. Nearly 4 years ago, he was brutally attacked at the Chautauqua Institute in New York by a knife-wielding assailant who stabbed him multiple times. Rushdie was near death when he arrived at the local hospital where the staff was able to save him. He wrote about his medical ordeal, the difficult recovery, and the power of love in his memoir, Knife. He has lost an eye and has permanent nerve damage. His attacker was sentenced last year to 25 years in prison for attempted murder. Salman Rushdie says he has moved on from the knife attack, and he's just written a new book, The 11th Hour, a quintet of stories. They're about the things that Rushdie has cared about: storytelling, the imagination, language, freedom of speech, the line between truth and lies, migration, and now, not surprisingly, age and mortality. Salman Rushdie joins us on the show today to talk about all of this and to read from his new book. He has written novels and stories and books of nonfiction, including Midnight's Children, which received the Booker Prize, The Satanic Verses, Shalimar the Clown, Quixote, and a memoir, Joseph Anton, the alias he used when he was hiding because of the fatwa. And Salman Rushdie, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Very nice to be with you.
And it's so nice to see that you are up and around and recovering, I guess I should say, from the attack of almost 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much back. You know, I mean, obviously, there are things that won't recover, like the lost eye. But other than that, I'm pretty much backed up to speed.
What does it feel like to be writing fiction again, writing your stories again?
Kind of joyful, actually. Because I was worried about having maybe lost that, you know. In the aftermath of the attack, I certainly was unable to think about anything like a story or a novel. And I told myself that in order to get back to that, I would have to go through the subject of the attack and write about it. And it actually worked, because very soon after I finished writing the memoir, it's like a little door in my head where the stories live.
The door
opened up and stuff came tumbling out. So I'm very happy to see them.
Did you find in writing Knife, though, it was a way of not just understanding the story, but controlling what happened to you?
Yes, it was a way of taking charge of it, you know, making it sort of mine. You know, so I'm not very good at playing the victim. You know? And I thought in this way, you know, instead of me being simply the subject of a knife attack, I become the author of the book about the knife attack. and the attacker, instead of being, as it were, the actor in the story, becomes one of my characters. So he belongs to me now.
This new book is called The 11th Hour. And I think of that phrase as, I mean, there are multiple meanings, but of course, you know, something that's sort of the very last moment, or this kind of sense of urgency that we feel about the 11th hour. What does that title mean to you?
It means all those things, you know. Certainly, you know, as we've been saying, I had a pretty good look at the end of the story.
Indeed.
You know, I got very close to it. And so that makes you think, you know, and getting older makes you think. I mean, in a couple of months, I'll be 79. The subject of the being in Act Five of the play, you know.
Right.
And I began to think a lot about how artists have and do approach that final act, you know. Sometimes with acceptance and peace and resignation and so on, and sometimes with rage. You know, Dylan Thomas's famous line about rage against the dying of the light, you know. I mean, I've always thought it was very interesting that Beethoven in his old age was in a really bad temper. You know, he hated being deaf, he hated getting old, but what did he do? He wrote the Ninth Symphony, of which the heart is the ode to joy. So in the middle of his very bad mood, he wrote about joy.
So what is your state of mind these days about turning almost 79?
Well, what I came to the conclusion that it doesn't have to be either or. You know, it doesn't have to be sort of peace and resignation or rage. It can be one on Tuesday and another on Wednesday. And so my characters in this collection, in many ways, a lot of them are facing that question, and responding to it in complicated, confused, you know, changeable ways.
In fact, the first and last stories are about old men. It's a lot about mortality and death. In the South, which is the first story, there are these old friends. They happen to call themselves senior and junior, and they like to bicker. In fact, there's a lot
Yes.
of bickering in this book of short stories that you've written, Salman Rushdie. How come?
I don't know, quarrelsomeness is funny, you
It
know.
is.
And what happened in that case of that story is that actually, those two stories you mentioned were written before the attack, so they weren't a consequence of it. I was in South India in the city which is now called Chennai, and I met a very cranky old gent, you know, who was just complained about everything. And, you know, but he was also very enjoyable. His complaints and sort of his bitching was really very, it was kind of sweet at the same time as being ornery. And so what I did is I kind of doubled him. I thought, let's have two of him and have them quarreling against each other.
Have
And
you had
that became the germ of the story.
one of them says to the other, "Your gloom and doom will be the death of me."
Yes. And one says to the other, you look like somebody who's just waiting to die. And the other one replies, yeah, but that's better than looking like you just waiting to
Do
live.
you have you had or do you have friends like that that you can bicker with?
I have some, yeah. Yes, and I mean, I just thought it's a story which is almost entirely about conversation. And I like that, you know. I mean, some of my stories have had very little dialogue. This one is all dialogue, really. So that makes a change.
In fact, Junior says in this story, "I don't believe in an immortal soul. I believe in a mortal soul," which I think is something that you wrote about yourself in Knife. But
Yes, I mean,
how do you make that distinction? What's the difference for you?
it really comes, it, to be truthful, it comes from Aristotle. I mean, he had this idea that, yes, there is something in the body which is a spirit, you know, which is not entirely of the body, but is in the body. But he also said that he didn't think that it was immortal. He thought the idea he had was that the spirit dies when the body dies. And so that idea of the mortal soul, you know, the thing that we all recognize as in us, but isn't entirely flesh and bones and blood, you know, but where maybe it doesn't survive us.
It goes with us.
Goes with us, yes.
The last story is the old man in the piazza, and again, this is an old man, as you describe, and he likes to go down every day to this piazza in this village or town where he lives, and just watch people and listen to people. That is something I personally enjoy doing when I'm traveling. Does that describe you as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a eavesdropper. I like to know how people talk to each other. And he's like that, and then he gets drawn into the arguments, you know, which is better not to do.
Exactly. And interestingly, you make language a character in this story, and you make
Yes.
her a woman. And I was curious why a female? Why a woman?
You know, I don't know, she just walked into the story. I wasn't expecting her. I mean, I was writing this story we've been talking about this old man who watches the world go by and quarrel with itself, and then he gets drawn into the arguments. I thought that's the story. But then this character just walked into the piazza and sat down and announced herself as being the embodiment of language. And it actually made me think, oh, actually, that's what the story's about. It's actually about how we use language, how language can be damaged, how it fights against being restrained. And the idea of her being a character, I just found myself really liking it, although it was a moment completely unexpected. Some of those magic moments that happen sometimes when you write, when something shows up And you think, oh, I never thought of that, but here it is.
Well, I would love to have you read a section from this book, and this is again in the piazza. And while the old man goes to hear and watch people argue, there was a time when you had to say yes to everything, and frankly, you were not allowed to argue at all. So I'd just like to have you read that paragraph where you describe, I guess, what happened to words, but what did people say yes to all the time?
Yes, I mean, it's a kind of fantasy story. It supposes a moment in the immediate past of this unnamed city,
right,
where there had been rules about where people weren't allowed to disagree or dissent. They could only say yes. This is how it has been in the square ever since the end of the so-called time of the yes. That dark age began 40 years or so ago, a time when, for a period of half a decade, it was made illegal to argue. We all were obliged to agree at all times. Whatever proposition was made, no matter how risible, the transubstantiation of bread and wine into flesh and blood, the nocturnal metamorphosis of the immigrant population into drooling sex monsters, the benefits of raising the taxes paid by the poor, the transmigration of souls, or the necessity of war, it was forbidden to debunk it, even though immigrants ran the best bakery in town and our favorite wine store, and even though most of us are poor, and none of us remembers an earlier time, an earlier life as tortoises or foreigners or eels, and only a small minority of us are warlike by nature. It was necessary at all times to assent.
I love that paragraph, and we're up on our first break here. But what strikes me about that is when living in the time of yes, one lives in a time of lies. Is that a takeaway for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it obviously has some contemporary resonances, you know, because I think we live in that kind of time now.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Salman Rushdie. He is the author of more than 20 books, and his most recent one has just been published. It's called The 11th Hour, and it's subtitled A Quintet of Stories. And we're talking with Salman Rushdie about some of the ideas and themes that have run through most of his books, and we've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and our guest today on the show is Salman Rushdie, and he has written, as I'm sure you know, many, many books. His most recent one is A Quintet of Stories, and it's titled The 11th Hour. Just picking up on language, this character that walked into the story, and I would imagine as a writer, that those are magic moments when something shows up in a story that you feel like you didn't really have control over, and yet in this story, there she was.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. You know, when that happens, it's a kind of pleasant surprise, and then you have to decide if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Right.
And so, in the end, I decided it was a very good thing.
And how so? Just curious.
Well, she just seemed like a great character. You know, she was as language might be, she was outspoken.
Right. Literally.
Yeah, she had very strong opinions, and she got upset when people tried to restrict her freedom. And in the end, she gets very angry. And I liked all that. I thought it actually gave the story its shape, which was an unexpected shape.
Well, she says it's even possible, or maybe you write, it's even possible, although it's hard for her to admit it, even to herself, that she may die. Nobody's listening. Nobody cares. Our words fail us. And in fact, the very last line of that story is exactly those words. Our words fail us. So while language is alive, it's what, on life support, or it's, are you worried?
I just felt I just felt that one of the things I was thinking was that we live in a moment where, let's say, the divisions between us are so great that we can hardly talk to each other. You know, that even though we theoretically are using the same language, we don't seem to be able to communicate with each other. And I think when language arrives at that kind of crisis point, where it becomes hard, even if you're speaking the same language, it becomes hard to communicate, you know, then that's a very dangerous state of affairs. And so that story is a kind of warning. I think it's the most allegorical of the stories in the collection.
Right.
And it does end up offering that warning, saying, you know, what happens when our words fail us?
Well, in fact, you write in The Musician of Kahani, the present decay of ethical society around the world is a matter of some concern. Words such as good and bad or right and wrong are losing their effect, emptying the meaning and failing anymore to shape society. And you go on from there. And I think I know exactly. I feel like we are living in this moment. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, that story is not set in America. It's set in India, and it's sort of contemporary. It's not, the date isn't exactly specified, but I do think that the problem is not unique to the United States. You know, I think we're just living in this moment where, I mean, those in power feel unleashed. You know, and the rest of us must worry about the consequences of that. You know? And yet, it seems as if the kind of ethical basis of society is eroded. You know? So, somewhere in that paragraph that you began to read, there's a sentence about it being a kind of time of shamelessness is king.
In fact, you say you write in this story, these are the days in which shamelessness is king. And I think of shame as, you know, when you shame someone, it's you're shaming who they are, versus if you guilt them, it's often what they do. But to be shameless is to not care, obviously, but also to feel free to do whatever you want.
Yes, it's curiously liberating to really not give a damn what your actions actually mean or what they come out of or what their consequences might be, as long as they're things you want. You know? And I think that's a condition that's worldwide right now. You know, I think it's, you could find many versions of that in many parts of the world. And if you're a writer, all you could, I mean, we don't have, you know, we have no guns. We have no armies. But what we can do is name it, name the problem, you know, so that people have a way to think about it.
Speaking to that and picking up on, I guess, what's happening in the news these days, I'm just curious, as someone who believes so deeply in free expression and the First Amendment, when you see ICE agents dragging people off, disappearing them, terrorizing people, threatening people, and in one case, shooting a woman in Minneapolis. Yes. Government officials are being targeted because of things that they have said about the president. What are your thoughts these days?
Well, I would have said until now that it was unthinkable that such things would happen in the United States. That people who are not even police officers, they're not even you know, members of the security forces, they're kind of essentially a private army, masked, hiding themselves and behaving with absolute disregard for ordinary laws and for civilized behavior, you know? And I mean, the fact that this lady was shot in the face three times. For what? You know, I mean, even if you disobey a police officer, the police officer doesn't shoot you in the face. You know, there's no reason for her to be dead, except that she was murdered. And that's not the first person that has died during this time of the activity of ICE. and probably won't be the last.
Do you think words, stories are any match for that level of violence?
I feel, I don't know, this is just my opinion, that this particular event, the shooting of Miss Good, has really upset people. Really, I think it's actually gone beyond a certain tipping point. And yes, all we can do is talk about it and argue and demonstrate and make our case. And let's hope that that goes on. I mean, I think there's a rising tide in this country to go back to the kind of America that people like me admired. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I came to live in America was the First Amendment. You know, I thought a society which enshrines the right to say your piece in the Constitution, that's a place worth living in, a place which includes the right to happiness, the pursuit of happiness in its Constitution. I thought, you know, that's the only country in the world that enshrines that right. And these are, you know, I think one of the things to say is that all countries, all the time, always, all countries are actually a composite of many countries. You know, in any country, there's a bit you like and there's a bit you don't like so much. And I just like us to get back to the bit I like.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Salman Rushdie. He's the author of more than, I counted, I think, more than 25 books. I believe I have that right. And again, his memoir that he wrote just about 2 years ago is titled Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. And his new book is a collection of five stories, I guess three long ones, two short ones, and it's called The 11th Hour. In one of your novels, in fact, it was Shame, written in which you wrote in 1983, you wrote, "I too, like all migrants, am a fantasist. I build imaginary countries." Is your imagination, does that feel like your home country?
I mean, to a large amount, it does, you know, because, I mean, I'm a double migrant. You know, when I left university, I decided not to return to India and settled in England. And I was there for a long time. And then for the last 25 years or more, I've been living in New York. So I'm a double migrant. And so one of the feelings you have as a consequence of migration is that you can't take the ground beneath your feet for granted. You know, you actually have to imagine it. You have to imagine the land you stand on. And I find, like, as a writer, that it's what it's made for me is the subject of place is incredibly important to me as a writer. You know, until I'm absolutely clear of the where and when of the story, I can't write it. I can't start. I don't know where my feet are going to fall, and I don't know where there's enough grip for the wheels to turn. You know, so I have to start with place always. And I think people for whom place is not a given often think like that. I sometimes envy the writers for whom place is a given, you know, writers who are deeply, deeply rooted in a place, like Faulkner in Oxford, or like William Kennedy in Albany, or, you know, like Eudora Welty in Jackson. Those people who can simply be of and from one corner of the world and make a lifetime of work out of it. I think, you know, that must be cool. But that's not my experience, and so you have to use what you got.
Yeah, but I wonder, I don't know, I don't want to make a broad statement, but whether migration then is good for the imagination. I know travel is, when you get out of, you know, the familiar surroundings and you see things that you've never seen before, it's exciting, and you sort of feel the brain cells getting tantalized.
But I mean, I do think, you know, the thing about migration is whether you're an individual or a family or a larger group, you have to reimagine yourselves. You know, when you come to a new life in a new place, you have to rethink yourself. You have to think, what of the world I brought with me do I want to keep? What do I need to discard and adopt something of the world that I've come to? You know, you very often You find yourself in a world where your natural, your first language is not the language around you, and you have to begin to be able to function in that language. So in all sorts of ways, making an act as radical as migration, uprooting yourself from the place you came from and coming to a new place, requires a colossal act of imagination, rethinking yourself, as well as rethinking the world you've come to.
So many people change their names when they move to a new place, and names seem to be sort of important to you as a writer.
Yes, I like naming. I always really admired Dickens for the wonderful names. Mr. the headmaster called Wackford Squeers. To name only one. That's Nicholas Nickleby. But Oliver Twist. It's
Great name.
fantastic, fantastic name. I've always been very interested in naming. And also, if you come from where I come from, if you come from India, that part of the world, when you think a lot about the meaning of the name. I mean, in the West, when you name a child, it could just be because it's a name in your family, or you just like the sound of it, or whatever. What you don't think about, what does it mean? Whereas in the my where I came from, parents naming children always wonder about the meaning of the name. My father naming me Salman means peaceful. See, there we are. He was right.
He was right.
But you think about that. So when I'm naming fictional characters, I also try and think about the implications of the name. What thoughts does it give one? And it's just another way of thinking about names. But I got it from Dickens, really, because I don't think anybody is as great a namer as
As
Dickens.
Mr.
Maybe
Dickens.
Saul Bellow.
When you were in hiding, you were Joseph Anton.
Yeah, I made him up because we needed a false name in order to write checks and things like that. And I made him up out of two writers that I admired. So it's Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. I put them to, I tried out other combinations and they didn't sound so good.
Picking up on
But
something we, yeah.
I thought Joseph Anton might actually exist.
Well, I remember interviewing you about the book, about your memoir of that time. I'm curious though, when we're, I mean, we seem like we're awash with lies and distortions and even AI, that it's hard sometimes to know, what is real, what is true, what isn't true. You talked in one of your books, I think it was Quixote, about the sort of smudge between what's real and what's not real. How, as a writer, do you, I don't know if you struggle with that or how do you see
Well,
that?
I think you have to see yourself as being on that smudged boundary, and I think a lot of, my books, which people talk about the sort of surreal elements of my books, but actually the kind of before I was a fiction writer, I was a historian. So I'm very interested in history and facts, and I teach at the NYU Journalism School, so I'm interested in all that. But just to be on that boundary between what's identifiably, provably so, and what's obviously not so. I think fiction exists on that frontier, and it can be very helpful because telling stories that are obviously not true can be ways of getting to the truth. And we all know that carpets don't fly, and that genies don't come out of bottles. But some of the best stories ever told include flying carpets and genies out of bottles. And it's because the purpose is always to tell us something about human nature. And the truth of literature is always, who are we? What are we like? Why are we like that? Why do we behave towards each other in the way that we do? And what does it mean? And that can be told through fantasy or realism. That depends on your inclination as an artist.
In Knife, you include a speech you gave at PEN in 2022, PEN, not PENN, where you say, above all, we must understand the stories are at the heart of what's happening, and the dishonest narratives of oppressors have proved attractive to so many, so we must work overtime to To turn the false narratives of tyrants, populists, and fools by telling better stories than they do, stories within which people want to live. But as a writer, I mean, I guess that's your job, right? To tell a better story?
I resist the idea of stories that have to preach at people. You know, I don't, as a reader, I don't like a story that wags its finger in my face and says, think like this.
Right.
You know, but that, what I said in that speech was that you have to create universes, worlds. The book is a world in which the reader should want to be. You know, you should like being in it. You know? And then if you create such a world, you can ask questions. You can suggest to people that the way they have thought about things may not be the only way to think about them, but here's another way. Try this one. Or try this one. You can ask questions. You can challenge people. You can hopefully sometimes change people's minds. But the point of the game is to create the world in which people want to live. And yes, I mean, it's true that you know, those who exercise not just power, but control over the narrative, you know, over the news media and so on, are trying to impose a version of reality upon us. And one of the things that literature can do is challenge that.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Salman Rushdie. And again, he's got a new book. It's called The 11th Hour, and it's a quintet, as he says, of stories. And a couple of years ago, he wrote a book about what happened to him in Chautauqua when he was nearly murdered. And that memoir titled Knife. And I do want to talk a little bit about some of the things that he writes about in Knife. And of course, we'll talk more about fiction and fantasies and stories. Do stay with us. We've got much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest is writer Salman Rushdie, who nearly died when he was stabbed multiple times at a literary festival in the summer of 2022. Since that time, he's written a memoir titled Knife and a new book of short stories called The 11th Hour. I do want to talk a little bit about what happened to you, and I hope you're okay, Salman Rushdie,
doing that,
because I think it's connected to what we have been talking about. And you describe in Knife about the fact that when you were near death, there was no tunnel of light, no feeling rising from your body. But you write, in fact, I have rarely felt so strongly connected to my body. My body was dying and it was taking me with it. It was an intensely physical sensation. Later, when I was out of danger, I would ask myself, who or what did I think the me was? And I have read that multiple times because it's so provocative to think about that moment. You know, we think of the body and the mind, this sort of dichotomy. And there you are, you know, nearly dying. And the me and the body are these two, both separate but together, parts of your existence.
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious. I mean, actually, I don't know that it was obvious to me at the time because my thinking was not what it should be. But the sense of watching yourself, you know, going through such an extreme experience. I think I was dimly aware of the fact that there was a me watching and there was a me being watched.
Yeah.
You know, and afterwards, when I was in better shape and writing the book, I wanted to just explore that idea. You know, because, I mean, I think it's well known that I'm not the most spiritual human being in the world.
Indeed.
and so I don't believe in, you know, things like an afterlife and so on. And certainly my experience of that near-death moment was in a way confirmed the absence of an afterlife because there was no sign of it. You know, I don't know when it's supposed to start, but certainly there were no pearly gates or boiling vats of hell. And I just thought, in spite of that, and in spite of my disbelief in such things, I think I, like most human beings, I believe that there's something which we call I or me,
mm-hmm.
which is not entirely just our physical self. not just the body that the eye inhabits. You know, the philosopher once referred to that as the ghost in the machine.
Right.
You know, and I think that idea of the ghost in the machine is a useful one. You know, but because I think we think of ourselves in that way. You know, we think of ourselves as having an entity which is not entirely of the body. You know, and so how do you describe that if you don't fall into the language of religion?
Right, right.
And that was one of the questions I was asking myself.
Well, I wanted, because you are an atheist, and I wanted to ask you whether that helped you as you struggled through this time of life. Often people of faith or people who believe in God or religion will talk about prayer and how much it helped them.
Yeah.
Did your atheism help you, do you think?
It didn't help, but it didn't hurt either.
Right.
You know, I mean, it just was a thing. I mean, a lot of people have asked me since whether it made, you know, because people have said with some justification that my survival was a kind of miracle.
Yeah.
And did it make me believe in miracles? Did it make me believe that some higher power intervened to save me? And I mean, actually, no, it didn't. It made me believe in certain kinds of miracles. It made me believe in medical miracles.
Yeah.
You know, and in the miracle of the skill of the surgeons, and also good fortune, luck. You know, I mean, there were ways in which I could have been wounded, which would have ended the story immediately.
You know, meaning he would have killed you.
Meaning he would have killed me if he kind of missed a couple of places which would have concluded the narrative right there. I mean, he almost killed me, you know, but he didn't, not quite. You know, and a lot of that just has to do with random good fortune. You know, so a combination of good luck and the skill of the surgeons, I believe in that, and I'm happy to call that a miracle, but I don't think it's a supernatural miracle. It's a miracle of the world.
How do you think about your body now? I mean, I think, you know, we all have minds and we have bodies, and some people use their minds more than their bodies, but how do you see your body now?
Well, one thing I learned in the period of recovery was that my body seems to be quite good at recovering.
It's good to know.
Yeah, that I mean, quite a lot of, you know, even after I was out of hospital and, you know, back in the world, I had a long period of having to be checked up all the time, you know, by various specialists in various injuries, you know, and many of them said to me, "You shouldn't be this well."
Wow.
You know, the recovery was way in advance of what they said, given the seriousness of the injuries. We wouldn't expect you to have recovered this well. So it, again, we're talking about good fortune. For some reason, I appear to have, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not fantastically physically fit. I'm not an athlete. You know, I don't have those ways of strengthening the body. But just by some good fortune, my body seems to be unusually good at healing. And that's good to know.
It sure is. Exactly. One of the stories, it's sort of a ghost story in your new book. It's called Late. It's about a famous writer. And he says, or you write, "I always write out of I always write out of deep unhappiness. And ever since I came to the college, I've been happy. So writing has no longer felt necessary." And I pulled that quote out because, having read Knife, you're a happy man. You're in love with your wife. You know,
yes.
that your life has taken this amazingly wonderful, good turn in spite of obviously what had happened to you.
Yeah.
Is it hard to write about happiness?
Oh, it's always hard to write about happiness. Yes, I mean, the famous line of the French writer Henri de Montaigne, who said, "Happiness writes white."
You know? Oh gosh,
it doesn't show up. Doesn't show up on the page.
Yeah,
but. And there's a story within the story, one of the stories, where I talk about starting to write a story about a happy person. And you immediately run into the problem of how can you be genuinely happy in the face of what's happening all around you in the world?
Indeed.
So is happiness a kind of delusion, you know, a sort of self-delusion? On the other hand, if you're consumed by what's happening in the world, what does that do to yourself? So maybe it's better for yourself to assert itself and say, actually, my life is good. Or is that selfish? So all that kind of question arises when you face the subject of happiness. And yet it's for that reason, the fact that it's so difficult to write about makes it irresistible to write
Indeed.
About.
Yeah. Yeah. You were in therapy for a while. Was that helpful? Did
yeah,
it help
very
you?
Helpful. Yeah, it's very helpful. I'm still in therapy. Yeah. Not quite as intensely as I was, but I still have an excellent therapist and I check in with him, you know, and talk to him about how I'm feeling,
right.
You know, but it was very helpful to have a really intelligent mind, which was not a friend or a family member, just focusing, even if only for like, you know, an hour every week or twice a week, focusing on what, how my mind was working and what was going on. You know, and I mean, I asked him for advice, you know, I asked him about post-traumatic stress disorder and how that functioned and what could be done about it. And you know, he was very constructive. So yeah, I mean, that's another part of the recovery.
I read that, or perhaps you wrote a knife that you didn't feel anger towards your assailant or even towards what had happened to you.
Well, I wouldn't say I never felt angry, but what I did feel is that it's kind of useless. If what you want to do is get back to your real life and to proceed with it, then anger becomes a burden that you have to carry, you know, and actually weighs you down. So if you really want to proceed, as opposed to being stuck in the moment, you kind of have to let go of it, you know? And when I was in the courtroom during the guy's trial,
yeah,
and I saw him sitting across the courtroom from me, I thought, you're really very unimpressive. I thought, you're a little squirt. And then another voice in my head said, yeah, but little squirts could kill you.
Yeah.
And he almost did.
And he almost did.
But I just find it easier than I thought to put him out of my head, not to have him weighing on me.
In fact, as I understand it, you spoke at his trial and you said to him, you are irrelevant to me. I don't care about you.
Yeah, and that is more or less what I think. I mean, I think he was almost extremely relevant to me. I mean, if he'd actually succeeded in killing me, that would have been very relevant. But given that he didn't and that I was able to recover and that, you know, I've written two books since then.
Right.
I mean, my life has gone on.
Is that
and I like that. I like that.
Is that, I never liked the word closure, but it's a title of one of your chapters in Knife. Does that feel like closure to you?
Well, I mean, whatever closure is, you know,
yeah.
It just feels like, you know, to use a literary sense, it feels like turning the page. You know, okay, yes, there was that. It was a very big moment in any human life, something like that. But that was then. Then you turn the page and this is today. And I've always had the maybe helpful quality of not thinking too much about the past. I do think about the past as a writer, because some of my books go back into the past. But as a person living out his days, I prefer to think about tomorrow than yesterday. You know, I don't very often pick up and read my old books, for example.
I wonder whether that's something that immigrants do more than people who stay put.
Yeah, that may well be the case. I don't know. I haven't done the survey, you know, but I do think that if you're starting over, you know, then looking forward is very important, you know. And I've had to start over a couple of times. And now, actually, you can argue that after this attack and this near-death experience, starting over again in another way.
Yeah.
You know?
You also went back to Chautauqua, I guess the scene of the crime with your wife. Was that healing?
Yeah, I mean, I understood quite soon, actually. I mean, well before I was physically well enough to attempt such a journey, I understood that I would like to do that. I would like to show myself that I was alive and well in the place that I was almost died. And so it was an ambition of mine, even a kind of goal of mine, through the recovery period. And then when I did get well enough, I said to my wife, I said to Eliza, I said, let's do it, you know? And we did, and it was very helpful, I think, to both of us.
It's so strange and I mean, I guess ironic, because you were there to give a talk about free speech, the importance of protecting writers, and there was really no security at Chautauqua.
I know, it's very weird, because the reason I was there was that long time ago, when I was still living in the UK, I was one of the group of people who set up an organization to provide refuge in different cities around Europe for writers who needed a safe place. Cities of Refuge, it's called. And now it's called the International City of Refuge. It's called ICORN, which is an acronym for International Cities of Refuge Network. And now it's spread. I mean, I've not been directly involved with it for a long time, but it's spread into South America. There's actually even in the United States. Oddly, the first one to join in the United States was Las Vegas.
Oh, interesting. It's a good place for conference, I guess, right?
Yes. And then Pittsburgh, Henry Reese, who was the other person on stage with me, had founded a Pittsburgh branch of this network. And it had been going for, 20, 25 years, and we wanted to talk about its achievements.
Yeah.
So I was there to talk to him about him, really, not about me, and about how well he had succeeded in giving safe refuge to a number of writers over the last couple of decades. And then it turned out to be I was the writer who needed protecting.
Yeah, yeah. You wrote it in Knife, we contain within ourselves both the possibility of murdering an old stranger for almost no reason, and we also contain the antidote to the disease, courage, selflessness, the willingness to risk oneself to help that old stranger lying on the ground. Is that how you see human nature?
Well, that's what happened. That's what happened. You know,
literally.
I felt that I experienced almost simultaneously the worst of human nature and the best of it. You know, on the one hand, bigotry, murderousness, fanaticism, etc. And on the other hand, people, I mean, Henry, not a young man, he's in his 70s. Also,
he was the man
like
interviewing
me.
You, yeah.
And he ran across, he was the first person to run across the stage and tackle a 24-year-old man with a knife. And then people jumped up from the audience and helped. And if it wasn't for Henry and the audience, I wouldn't be here talking to you. Because they sat on him.
Because they sat on him. We're almost out of time here, but you have said that optimism is your greatest strength and or your greatest weakness. Still true today?
Yeah, I think, to be a writer requires an amount of optimism because, you sit in a room for often several years making something in the hope that when you offer it to the world is going to like it, and you can't do that without optimism. So optimism is really the fuel of literature, I've always thought, and still, for me, it still is.
Well, it's always a great pleasure, Salman Rushdie, to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you as well. And again, Salman Rushdie's new book is called The 11th Hour, A Quintet of Stories. And the other book we were referencing is titled Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find the show on Facebook. Check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.